It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Freddie.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This is an episode we like to call You Ask Us. Hello, I'm Anoush Shakelian, Britain editor at The New Statesman and host of this podcast. And joining me in the studio, I have Freddie Haywood, our political correspondent, and Rachel Cunliffe, our associate political editor. And we've been digging around in our virtual mailbag again and have brought a couple of questions to discuss. So, Rachel, I think you've got the first question.
Yes, this one is from Derek, who says, how would a Labour government handle Northern Ireland and the DUP? Very topical for this week.
Yeah, so we've had the news this week that power sharing is likely to return to Stormont, which has been without a government for 2 years. And that's now that the government has set out a new post-Brexit trade arrangement between Northern Ireland, the rest of the UK and the EU. And the DUP is willing to accept that arrangement. There's also the matter of £3.3 billion that the government is giving to the Northern Ireland's budget. And of course, they've had a general strike and their public services are in a real state. So they need that money. Freddie, before we go on to discuss Labour's relationship, which is what the question is specifically on, can you just take us through what these new arrangements mean?
Yeah, so the key thing about this is it's an appendix. It's a refinement of the Windsor framework that we had last year. So if you cast your mind back to then, the hope was that the DUP would return to Stormont because they had this new relationship. That did not happen. The government says they've been negotiating with the DUP behind closed doors for days and weeks and months to get to where they are now. And in many ways, it's not that fundamental a change. It's quite superficial. So you've got two things. You've got the reduction of some trade barriers between Britain and Northern Ireland. That's one of the key things. So it's, again, it's the refinement of some of those original arrangements that the Windsor framework set up. So for instance, the Green Lane, that famous Green Lane, which is for goods just going from Britain to Northern Ireland and not to the EU, has been recast as this UK internal market system. Mm-hmm. And then we've got another thing, which is more symbolic, and it's essentially about reassuring unionists in Northern Ireland that they are part of the United Kingdom. So you're going to have some constitutional guarantees put into a bill which is being debated today, I think. And it essentially tries to bind future governments and says you need to consider Northern Ireland when you try and negotiate with the EU or when you try and introduce new trading arrangements. Of course, any parliament can do whatever they want in the future. But it's that symbolic gesture to say, okay, yeah, you very much are part of the United Kingdom. So it's a combination of the two that sort of allowed the DUP and Geoffrey Donaldson to say to his party, look, I think we've got a good deal here, let's go back in.
Okay, that's to allay the fears of the unionists that they might be left to go by EU rules while the rest of the UK pulls away from them.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Rachel, I mean, this follows on from the Windsor framework, like Freddie mentioned. That was seen as an early success of Rishi Sunak's premiership. I think it was around this time last year. Has he finally got Brexit done by returning power sharing to Stormont?
Well, I don't think Brexit is ever going to be truly done. Certainly, I speak to a lot of Conservative Brexiteers who don't believe we've even started to get Brexit done. But I think we should take a moment to recognise how significant this achievement is and how significant the Windsor Framework achievement, February 2023, was as well. One of the key sticking points was this idea of a democratic deficit in Northern Ireland. So that Northern Ireland would be subject to rules and regulations from the EU imposed by Brussels without any say because they don't have representation in the EU Parliament anymore. And one of the things this tweak appendix change does is it allows the Northern Ireland Assembly, when it is back up and running, so it's another incentive to get it back up and running, to scrutinise EU rules and changes and say, yes, this works or no, it doesn't. And symbolically, that is huge. It's also a pretty major concession from the EU. And when Boris Johnson was trying to solve this exact problem, before him, Theresa May was trying to solve this problem, but when Boris Johnson was trying to solve it, relations with the EU were so bad, were so toxic, they wouldn't even talk to British negotiators about this issue. And the idea that any that there could be anywhere that had access to the EU single market and wasn't following the rules or any kind of special pleading, special case for Northern Ireland, just wasn't on the table at all. And what changed was the leader and a reset in relations. And I don't think we should underestimate how symbolic and important that was, that basically Britain's policy, Britain's intention, attitude, what Britain was asking for, what Northern Ireland was asking for, didn't really change between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. What changed is you've got a group of people in the room who said, no, we don't want to have a massive fight with you. We're not going to put out briefings and counter briefings about how evil the EU is. We really want to fix this. And the word that keeps getting thrown up is pragmatic. You had people on all sides. So in Northern Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, in Westminster, and in Brussels, who really were very invested in finding a way round this. And they were able to do it because there was trust, which there hadn't been before. So I think, are there still some Brexiteers who are a bit annoyed about this? Yes. Are there still some members of the DUP who are very annoyed about this? Yes. Sammy Wilson was saying some very explosive things in Westminster about it all. It's not perfect. It is still a fudge, but it is a massive step forward that is only possible because we grew up a bit. And I think that's really important to remember.
And time has passed as well since the...
It's got less toxic. Yeah,
it's become less sensitive. But of course, Rishi Sunak has proved himself to be a sort of more natural diplomat than Liz Truss and Boris Johnson. And that brings us on to Derek's question. He talks about how Labour would handle Northern Ireland and the DUP. And in general, I think the attitude in Labour about what they would bring to the relationship with the EU is that more grown-up, pragmatic, diplomatic approach. So if it's proven to work to an extent under Sunak, then maybe that vindicates sort of Starmer's rhetoric on that. But it's interesting because I think Labour have been aware for a long time that Northern Ireland and the island of Ireland in general is going to be a big challenge for them if they get into government. I've heard insiders say this, even more than the issue of Scottish independence would present a challenge to them. Because if power sharing returns, then we'll likely have the first Republican First Minister, Sinn Féin First Minister in Northern Ireland. Then you've got the Irish elections next year, when you could get Sinn Féin in government in Ireland. And then the matter of a border poll and Irish unification becomes a big issue, something Labour would have to navigate. There's a lot of people in Labour who take this very seriously. So Peter Cull, who was the former shadow Northern Ireland secretary, actually said that Labour would act more as a neutral arbiter on Northern Ireland issues than perhaps the current government or the governments we've seen that have been the very outwardly unionist about it all. I think the new tweak to the Windsor framework is called safeguarding the union, isn't it? So they've said that they would take a slightly different, more kind of Blair Brown era attitude towards it. And then you've got a lot of people, you've got a lot of personnel who really understand Northern Ireland as well. So Starmer himself worked for 5 years advising the policing board there. And then Sue Gray, she worked in Northern Ireland running a pub, but she also worked for the civil service there as well. And Morgan McSweeney himself, who is Irish, he joined the Labour Party because he was so inspired by the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. He's the campaign director in Labour. And then you now have Hilary Benn as well as the new shadow Northern Ireland secretary. And he worked a lot on Brexit trade arrangements when he was chair of the Brexit Select Committee. So there's quite a lot of sort of heads in the top tiers of Labour who understand Northern Ireland seriously as an issue, and they have acknowledged privately and I think publicly as well that this is going to be something they will need to focus on when they're in, if they're in government.
Yeah, I think in the short term, the priority is very much maintain the executive in Northern Ireland. Hilary Benn came out yesterday and said that quite explicitly. So that's going to be their key aim. You can't really have another 2 years of no executive because decisions, as we know, aren't being made and their public services suffer, pay rises can't happen, all of these knock-on effects of it. So that will be their priority in the short term, I think. So how do they achieve that, or will they achieve it? I think the key thing will be because the Labour government is going to pursue a close relationship with the EU. And we know that one of the key problems for Northern Ireland is when the UK government tries and pursues divergence from EU rules. Now, if a Labour government comes in and they're essentially going to try and agree a veterinary agreement, move closer on defence. Maybe that means also they're not going to move further away from the EU on regulation. So I think that's going to ensure that some of the problems that this new agreement and also the Windsor framework try to solve don't really come to the fore again. I mean, it will in some form, but it's less likely than it would, say, under a strong Brexiteer Conservative government. So I think in some ways, in the short term at least, this agreement, let's wait and see what the DUP do. But it seems, as you said, that they're going to return to the executive. Let's see what happens there. But in the short term, this does seem to have drawn some line.
And on a last symbolic point, one of the aspects of the new agreement is that there will be one meeting of the UK Westminster Cabinet in Northern Ireland a year once the Assembly is back up and running. Now, we don't quite know when that's going to be. We don't know when the election is going to be, but it is possible that it would be a Labour Cabinet having that first meeting.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's quite symbolic as well. That's never happened before. So the sort of legacy of this deal could be Keir Starmer's cabinet meeting in Belfast for the first time.
After the break, it's Freddie's turn to ask a question. Freddie, can you give us a clue on what's coming up?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the Labour backbenchers.
If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back after this.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So, Freddie, what's the question?
So this is a question from YouTube listener ChickenPie113, who says...
No less.
ChickenPie says... Which backbenchers will be influential, cause trouble for a Starmer-led Labour government, and potentially even launch a leadership bid?
And they have made the caveat, obviously there are plenty in the shadow cabinet, but what about the backbenchers? Because when I saw this question, I was going to talk about Wes Streeting and Bridget Phillipson and Rachel Reeves, but I think they're more interested in who...
No, we know all about them. This listener wants to go deeper.
Yeah. And actually, it's quite a hard question because there's not actually that many backbenchers.
No. The pool is very small.
Because the parliamentary party is so small because they got so few MPs in 2019.
Yeah. So who were you thinking?
So I've been speaking to people about this week and it was quite a strained conversation. No offence to Labour backbenchers. I think there are reasons for that. You're right. There aren't that many of them just because 2019 was such a heavy blow to their number of seats. It's also because quite a few of them are leaving.
Yeah.
So you've got Harriet Harman's leaving, Margaret Hodge, John Curtis, Ben Bradshaw. So some of the heavyweights that are either in the new Labour government or have been quite vocal in the past 10 years or so, they're not going to be in Parliament after the next election. So it rules them out. Mm-hmm. And I think the broader point is that based on the current polls, there's going to be a huge influx of new, fresh...
Potential troublemakers.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't sound like that's going to be the case. Labour's office had such a tight grip on the selection process that you're almost going to have these sort of Starmerite robots potentially walking through Parliament who aren't going to cause that much trouble. And also remember, regardless of their political beliefs, you don't have necessarily the knowledge or the confidence or the support around you to cause much trouble if you've only been in Parliament for 1 year. So there is going to be a lag. We might see more trouble being made further down the line. But initially, I think there's not going to be many.
Rachel?
I had Nadia Whittam on my list, who has been interviewed by The New Statesman, if you want to go read that interview. So she was the youngest MP, that she still is the youngest MP. She entered Parliament in 2019 at the age of 23, which makes me feel very old. And she is, although she wouldn't necessarily self-define this way, but she's very much on the left of the Labour movement. And she's very good on social media. I realise that you can't measure politicians and influence by the number of Twitter followers they have, but she has 120 Twitter followers. And that has been a successful way for politicians of all parties to get in media attention and raise their profile. And I'm not suggesting that she would cause trouble for Starmer, but parties go in cycles, right? And trends come up and come down. And if you are thinking about, okay, who might be a representative of the left, maybe not in this parliamentary term, but in the future, I would keep your eyes on her, because obviously when the new influx come in, she's going to have had 5 years more experience in Parliament and could be significant in that front.
Just on the left, they're spoken about often as this potential threat to Keir Starmer if he gets in. I think the key thing at the moment is that they are quite disunified. We haven't seen a very well-organised operation in recent weeks. And we've also seen the leadership react very severely to any dissent from the party line over Gaza. We've seen suspensions of the whip and disciplinary measures being taken. So how that plays into a Labour government, I think, will be interesting. But that, yeah, they'll have to either get the numbers, organise themselves, patch over some of the internal schisms that are currently plaguing the left if they really want to challenge the Labour government. But also, it completely depends on the size of Keir's majority. So all of this is, you know, if he gets a 100-seat majority, it's not going to be that much of a problem for him.
Yeah. And I wonder if it would take someone new on the left side of things, but not necessarily the Corbynite side of things, coming in and being someone for that kind of disjointed group that you just described to rally around. I think someone like Miatta Fambula is quite interesting. Mm. She's running in Peckham. She was the head of the New Economic Foundation, which is a think tank that kind of rose to prominence in the Corbyn years because of its radical economics, but isn't necessarily tarnished by the baggage of that era. And obviously she's now very on message because she's a candidate, but she could be someone who might be pulling Labour to the left in terms of their economic policy, which at the moment looks very conservative by British political standards. But there'll be some figures like her hoping that will change once they get into government. And it was interesting, I'm not saying he's a leadership contender, but I interviewed Liam Byrne, the interview's out today, we're recording on Thursday morning, and he's someone who served in the New Labour government, famously left the note that said there is no money, was a sort of New Labour minister and advisor in that time. And he's very much changed his perspective on how Labour should be running the economy as well, and was warning me. He was saying from day one they need to, you know, radically change how the economy works in terms of our broken markets and the inheritocracy that we have, the wealth inequality. He's written a book about it. And he was like, if they don't do that, then they'll have no chance of changing things for the better in terms of the things that we actually are Labour MPs for, like equality and fairness and getting rid of food banks. So there's a sort of bit of a cross-factional concern about the status quo in terms of the economy that could bubble up.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in a leadership challenge, but I do think it will be a challenge for them when they get in.
And you've also got people who have been around a long time and who know that their own leadership.
He's been around a long time.
So
he's a select committee chair.
People like Barry Gardner
as
well. People who are on the select committees.
Diana Johnson, I'd add.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the other thing I would mention, if we're looking at new MPs who might be influential, you've got to look at Scotland. So Labour, traditionally, there have been a lot of superstar Labour politicians that came from Scotland. Obviously, since 2015, there haven't been all that many. But if Labour is going to retake...
Literally.
If Labour is going to retake a whole load of seats north of the border, then that tradition could come back.
Yeah,
and that's
Douglas
also going to be... That's going to be really important in terms of keeping the union together and keeping the SNP at bay when they decide to...
Get their act together
and sort themselves out.
It's interesting what you were saying, Anoush, about what these people might be advocating. So I think rather than look at individuals, we can look at the issues.
Yes.
So the 28 billion, as we've seen in recent weeks, has caused some friction, some division within the party. And I think, you know, before an election, they're going to be very focused on message discipline. Once and if they do get into government, I think you will see some on the left, some backbenchers feel as if there's more leeway because they're not so concerned about losing this generational chance to have a Labour government. They might be more strident, more confident in coming out and say, well, no, actually, we do need to be slightly more radical on the economy. I mean, it's, the other thing as well is foreign policy. I think you have seen drip, drip, drip since October 7th and since the party conference. You have seen... week on week, dissent and party management has not gone that well. It's also not hitting the headlines as it was, I think, in part because Keir Starmer managed to shut down the conversation with his Chatham House speech last year, but it's still there. I mean, like Sarah Owen, who I was speaking to someone that, you know, they offered her name up as someone who could be a more prominent backbencher going forward. She was PPS to Rachel Reeves. She resigned over Gaza. She's also resigned over previous stuff in the past. So there are going to be flashpoints. And I think two of them will be foreign policy and left on the economy.
Great. Well, thank you, both of you. And thanks to everyone who submitted questions. We do read them all, so please keep them coming in. If you'd like to send one, you can go to newstatesman.com/youaskus. Or if you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and leave a reply. And YouTube viewers can drop a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Rachel Cunliffe and Freddie Haywood. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.